In an interview on CNN, U.S. President Joe Biden says if Israel invades Rafah, he'll cut off the weapons.
They go into Rafah. I'm not supplying the weapons that have been used historically to deal with Rafah.
Hong Kong's protest song has been banned.
If you don't like taking out the trash, there's a robot coming that'll do it for you.
It should be able to take our garbage out. It should be able to do things which we don't like to do and not the things we love to do.
Today is Thursday, May 9th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Scott Walterman, along with Alexis Strope.
U.S. President Joe Biden said he will stop some shipments of American weapons to Israel if it conducts a major invasion of Rafah. During an interview on CNN, Biden acknowledged that those weapons have been used to kill civilians in Gaza.
They go into Rafah. I'm not supplying the weapons that have been used historically to deal with Rafah, to deal with the cities, to deal with that problem. We're going to continue to make sure Israel is secure in terms of Iron Dome and their ability to respond to attacks like came out of the Middle East recently. But it's just wrong. We're not going to supply the weapons and the artillery shells used that have been used.
Artillery shells as well.
Yeah, artillery shells.
It was the subject of a congressional hearing Wednesday. U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin at the hearing.
And so we're going to continue to do what's necessary to ensure that Israel has the means to defend itself. But that said, we are currently reviewing some near-term security assistance shipments in the context of unfolding events in Rafah.
In testimony before the Senate Appropriations Committee, Austin said,
Israel shouldn't launch a major attack in Rafah without accounting for and protecting the civilians that are in that battle space. And again, as we have assessed the situation, we paused one shipment of high payload munitions. And again, I think we've also been very clear about the steps that we'd like to see Israel take to account for and take care of those civilians before major combat takes place.
During the hearing, U.S. Senator Lindsey Graham lashed out at the policy.
If we stop weapons necessary to destroy the enemies of the state of Israel at a time of great peril, we will pay a price. This is obscene. It is absurd. Give Israel what they need to fight the war they can't afford to lose. This is Hiroshima and Nagasaki on steroids.
So let's go deeper. Joining us now to talk about this is Rajan Menon. He's director of the Grand Strategy Program at Defense Priorities. So with this new information about President Biden saying he will halt some shipments of American weapons, which he acknowledged in the interview, have been used to kill civilians in Gaza if Prime Minister Netanyahu orders a major invasion of the city of Rafah. What do you think about that?
Well, the evidence that American weaponry has been used to kill civilians, not necessarily deliberately, but certainly that has been the result, we've long known. Now we come to the Rafah operation. It seems to me that the latest statement by the president amounts to a shot across the bow for Netanyahu, because the president is in an election year. The war in Gaza has turned out to be a net liability. For the first time, support for Israel on the part of a president running for re-election has become not an asset, as it always is, but something of a liability. So I think he's signaling to Netanyahu that he wants an operation that minimizes civilian deaths and the displacement of civilians, because he wants the consequences not to redound to his disadvantage, he, Biden. Do I think that this will lead to an actual stoppage of American military aid to Israel? I rather doubt it. And I think Mr. Netanyahu has a very good understanding of how difficult that would be for an American president to actually implement, that I don't think it's going to shape his operation very much at all.
The Israeli government was playing it down. The first initial reports were they were holding back a shipment of weapons. And at that point, the Israeli government was saying, look how much they've given us. We don't see this as a problem. I assume they're not going to change that position because of what you say.
Right.
As you point out.
Yeah, I think that Netanyahu notes what Biden has just said. Does he lie awake at night thinking that the United States would cut off military supplies? I don't think so. I think in part, Biden is trying to create, as it were, a verbal paper trail saying, look, I'm on record as having told the Israelis that they have to be mindful of civilian casualties and displacing civilians. But the long and short of it is that no matter how you slice it, a significant operation in Gaza will have that effect. It just simply has to. You can already see people being displaced and going to safe havens when there really are none. So the question is, if the operation continues and there is significant loss of life, additional loss of life, and additional displacement, will the administration really, as it were, pull the trigger and cut off aid? I don't think so. I don't think Biden really intends to do that. I don't think Mr. Netanyahu believes he will do that.
Do you think the Rafah ground operation is necessary for Israel beyond its ability to, at the end of the operation, to claim victory? I mean, in a real sense, going
right
in there. Yeah.
Right. So there's a wartime rationale, which is articulated by Mr. Netanyahu, is that this operation is all about destroying Hamas as a military operation. I don't see how he can destroy it as a political operation, because Hamas is an idea, and how one kills an idea is a much more complicated issue. But he said we have to break the back of Hamas. But there's a domestic political element. Netanyahu is the head of a coalition, and there are, believe it or not, parties in that coalition that are much further to right to the right than he. So you may have heard of people like the finance minister Bezalel Smotrich or the security minister Itamar Ben-Gavir. They've made it absolutely clear that they won't support the government unless the Rafah operation goes forward, and they're not terribly impressed by U.S. Finger wagging. And so Netanyahu faces not only a military challenge on the ground, that is, how does Rafah unfold and will it in fact lead to the defeat of Hamas, but he faces a political problem, which is that if he doesn't do it, his coalition could come unstuck. He could cease to be prime minister. And then there is a whole set of legal challenges that, as you know, he faces.
Thank you so very much for the time.
Appreciate it.
Rajan Menon with Defense Priorities.
In Washington, police began clearing out a pro-Palestinian encampment at George Washington University early Wednesday morning. According to the university's independent student-run newspaper, GW Hatchet, officers gave their third and final warning to demonstrators to move at about 3:30 a.m., saying all who remained would be arrested. At a news conference, Hala Amer, the mother of a George Washington University student, says the university's claims about diversity and free speech contrast their actions.
The GW administration strongly highlighted its support for diversity, free speech, and activism. But the administration's disgraceful response to this peaceful anti-genocide protest shows that those words were mere lip service.
Israeli women rallied in Tel Aviv on Wednesday, demanding the release of around 130 hostages still held in Gaza after 6 months of Israel's war against Hamas.
For us, every minute that there's a little bit hope sometimes makes it even harder, because you allow yourself to hope and then you fall again, because again it fails. So it's like a roller coaster.
Street demonstrations against the government by families and supporters of some of the more than 130 hostages still held in Gaza have become a constant fixture, with protesters demanding a ceasefire deal with Hamas to get them back.
Turkey's decision last week to stop all trade with Israel until Israeli leaders reach a permanent ceasefire in Gaza is likely to hit Israel's economy hard. Adding to those concerns are signs that Turkey is encouraging other nations in the Islamic world to do the same. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
Turkey's ports are now closed to all Israeli trade. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan says the embargo will only be lifted if there's a permanent ceasefire in Gaza. Erdogan on Tuesday called on the international community to put greater pressure on Israel, a move that analysts warn will have wider consequences.
Turkey became the first country globally to essentially impose a total trade embargo on Israel.
Last year, Turkish-Israeli trade was worth nearly $7 billion, of which more than $5 billion was Turkish exports. Israeli Foreign Minister Israel Katz condemned the embargo, but analysts warn the Israeli economy will still suffer. Israel relies heavily on Azerbaijani oil that is piped to Turkey's Ceyhan port and then shipped to Israeli refineries.
This will make Turkey and Israel put the relationship in enmity, in hostile situation, which will be for long years difficult to heal again.
Observers warn that restoring trade and trust could take a considerable time. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
We're following these other stories from around the world. Russian President Vladimir Putin Wednesday held talks with Armenian Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan on the sidelines of the Eurasian Economic Union Summit. Relations between Moscow and Yerevan are in a difficult phase, with Pashinyan looking to build closer ties with the West. The EAEU, an economic organization, includes Russia, Belarus, Armenia, Kazakhstan, and Kyrgyzstan as its members.
Chinese President Xi Jinping arrived in Budapest late Wednesday. Xi can expect a warm welcome in a country that is an important partner in trade and investment. In contrast with the other EU nations that he's visited that are considering diversifying away from China.
North Macedonia's right-wing opposition won big in parliamentary and presidential elections Wednesday, on a night that saw the Balkan country also elect its first female head of state. Gordana Siljanovska Dafkova, a university professor, beat incumbent Stevo Penderovski in a landslide.
In our continuing coverage of the 2024 U.S. presidential election, in the race between Joe Biden and Donald Trump, there will be 2 million more Asian American voters than there were 4 years ago, according to the Pew Research Center. VOA correspondent Scott Stearns reports on how Asian American lawmakers are getting out the vote.
Asian Americans are the fastest growing group of eligible voters in the United States, according to the Pew Research Center, but they are not uniform in their politics. Christine Chen is executive director of the nonpartisan Asian Pacific Islander American Vote Group.
So typically Indians and Japanese Americans are biggest supporters of Democrats, and Vietnamese Americans are actually large supporters of Republicans. Now, Chinese Americans, they have shifted from being Democrat to now their largest identification is independent. So what that is also telling me is that there's not enough engagement by the political parties and the campaigns to be able to educate them on the issues and what their campaign actually stands for.
Michelle Steele was born in South Korea and raised in Japan. The Republican congresswoman represents parts of California's Orange County and has Vietnamese language content on her website, as her district is home to one of the largest Vietnamese American communities in the United States.
You just go out there, each community, and you reach out in different way. Like, you know, for Vietnamese Americans, I have five outies and you wear their outfit. You go into Filipino community, I wear sari. And you know what? You do all these things and they know that you are one of them.
Steele says she and her supporters knocked on more than 190,000 doors during her reelection campaign 2 years ago.
That's the way you reach out to Asian American communities. It's all same for in my district, we speak 7 different languages, but they all say the same thing.
That door-to-door campaigning is especially important for Asian voters, of whom more than 70% used mail-in ballots and early voting in 2020, according to Chen.
It's because when you have a mail-in ballot, you can sit at your kitchen table, talk to your family and friends about the issues, about the candidates, and really be able to get the translation help and be able to not be under pressure to be able to figure out who you're going to vote for.
The importance Republicans are placing on Asian American voters concerns Grace Meng, a Democratic U.S. Congresswoman who represents a district in the New York City borough of Queens.
Well, I think there's been an increased sense of urgency lately because we have seen the Republican Party, some of their candidates doing that type of multilingual outreach. And so we've been saying to our own Democratic leaders and candidates, like, look, hey, we can't wait anymore. The other side is catching on, and we need to make sure that we're doing that outreach so people know which party truly stands and represents their values.
At the neighborhood Minh Quan Center for Community Action, Sandra Choi is Civic Participation Director.
We work on it year after year building political power for immigrants, for Asian American immigrants, for working class communities. But especially for the 2024 election, where there is so much on the line, we know that this is the moment to really mobilize our communities to understand their power in building something bigger, a bigger future for all of us this year.
Pew Research projections say 15 million Asian Americans will be eligible to vote this November. More than half of them live in just 5 states: California, New York, Texas, Hawaii, and New Jersey. Scott Stearns, VOA News.
Ghana's Supreme Court has delayed a battle over Africa's most restrictive anti-LGBTQ law. The court ruled that lawyers must remove insulting language in their submissions.
If you watch the court carefully, they virtually granted those two applications. So the directive to file or refile the entire process was virtually a repeat of those granting orders. And it was nothing untoward, so far as we are concerned.
Gay sex is already punishable with up to 3 years in jail in Ghana. If the bill takes effect, it will lengthen the sentence and intensify a crackdown on the rights of LGBTQ people and those accused of promoting lesbian, gay, and other minority sexual or gender identities.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Scott Walterman with Alexis Strope. The protest anthem called Glory to Hong Kong has been banned in Hong Kong. It was written in 2019 during mass pro-democracy protests and was considered an unofficial national anthem rather than China's March of the Volunteers. Court of Appeals judges wrote that the composer of the protest song had intended it to be used as a weapon. U.S. State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller.
We remain seriously concerned about the continued erosion of protections for human rights and fundamental freedoms in Hong Kong, including the freedom of expression. And the decision to ban this song is the latest blow to the international reputation of a city that previously prided itself on having an independent judiciary, protecting the free exchange of information, ideas, and goods.
The Olympic flame landed on French soil amid tight security Wednesday. kicking off a summer extravaganza of sport that President Emmanuel Macron hopes will showcase the splendors of France and burnish his legacy. The flame arrived in Marseille, a port city in southern France founded by Greek merchants, after a 12-day trip from Greece on board the Belem, a 128-year-old, three-masted tall ship that once transported sugar from France's colonies in the West Indies to the metropole.
And finally, tired of taking out the trash, of mopping the floor, of making the bed? Well, there's a robot for that. Well, okay, not yet, but it's coming.
I see it here between 5 and 10 years, yes. So 5 and 10 years you will have humanoids in the streets. And it's quite fast, but it's possible.
That's David Rieger, CEO of Nutra Robotics. He said it kind of fast, but I want to draw your attention to one thing that he just said. In 5 to 10 years, you will have humanoids on the streets. So I immediately thought of the movie iRobot, based on the Isaac Asimov short story, a world of humanoid robots doing the mundane things humans don't want to do.
It should be able to take our garbage out. It should be able to do things which we don't like to do and not the things we love to do. It's like drawing pictures or making, you know, writing nice stories or making movies or whatever. This is something what everyone would love to do, but we simply don't have time for that. And to get some time, we get this one.
Nura Robotics is designing a humanoid AI robot they've named for NE1. They brought it to Automate, North America's largest robotics trade show in Chicago, which, by the way, is where iRobot takes place. Coincidence?
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America.
On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thank you so much for joining us.
For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com.
In Washington, with Alexis Strope, I'm Scott Walterman.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Women farmers produce about half the world's food, while still more women work in ancillary industries, packing, transporting, storing, and selling food. And they do this despite having to navigate obstacles created for them, specifically because they are women. This is why the United States introduced a resolution in the United Nations General Assembly to declare the year 2026 as the International Year of the Woman Farmer. On May 2nd, the UN General Assembly passed this resolution. Of all the women in the world in the global labor force, 2/5 work in agri-food systems, said United States Permanent Representative to the UN, Linda Thomas-Greenfield. In many regions, that number is even higher, with more than 2 in 3 women in the labor force working in agri-food systems in sub-Saharan Africa and in South Asia.
They farm with less financial backing, less technology, less education, less cultural and governmental support than their male counterparts. This lack of training and resources and support doesn't just hamper women farmers' productivity, it holds back progress in every sustainable development goal, from combating climate change to ensuring economic stability to fighting food insecurity, which disproportionately affect women and girls.
By establishing 2026 as the International Year of the Woman Farmer, said Ambassador Thomas Greenfield, the international community has chosen to call attention to the challenges women in agriculture continue to face, and the ways in which governments, civil society, the private sector, and other stakeholders can help close the gender gap and get us closer to achieving the Sustainable Development Goals.
We aim to increase awareness of women's roles in farming and lack of secure land tenure that continues to hinder far too many of them. To better understand the financial and technological needs of women farmers and ensure access to credit and markets, education, and technology. To support changes in policies and social norms that empower women farmers and share best practices.
Ultimately, food security is national security. Food security is economic security, and above all, food security is a moral imperative. As President Biden has said, if parents cannot feed their children, nothing else matters, said Ambassador Thomas Greenfield. Today, a perfect storm of climate and conflict has driven tens of millions more people into hunger, said Ambassador Thomas Greenfield. But in the fight against food insecurity, we have a powerful tool, and that is women farmers.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.